It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
My guests are two out of the four members of the Mella Guitar Quartet. They're winners of the prestigious Guitar Foundation of America International Ensemble Competition from 2023. The quartet will perform as the final concert of the UNLV Performing Arts Center's 48th season, Saturday, March 15th at 7 p.m. at the Artemis W. Hamm Concert Hall. For ticket information, go to pack.unlv.edu. That's pack.unlv.edu. And for everything about the Mella Guitar Quartet, go to melagq.com. Say that three times real fast, melagq.com. And follow them on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And Matthew and Zara, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. Is there any chance of changing your website URL? Because that's a tongue twister, especially when you've got pollen in your brain like I do.
Have you heard of the Guitar Quartet, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet?
Yes.
They're a little inspiration for me. They're kind of guitar heroes. And so our website URL is melagq.
I got you.
It's almost like we're
sure enough.
Stealing some of that.
Now, just for our audience that are not familiar with the quartet, the two people with me, one is a founding member, Matthew Robinson, and then joined with Zara Hutton, who joined in 2023. And thank you both for joining the show and talking about the quartet. How did the quartet, I gave a little introduction about the quartet, but how did the quartet originally find its ground, find its way to operate and perform and be very successful in?
Well, it goes back to, it was about a decade ago that we set up. So I was a graduate student at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London. And there I met a couple of guitarists who, it's kind of a small world, the guitar world. And you meet people going through that you think are really good and that you get to be friends with and meet at various concerts and kind of throughout the progression of studying in the UK. So there's a thing called the National Youth Guitar Ensemble. And then you kind of maybe would progress from that to university and then maybe masters after that. So there's two guys, G. Verhausden and Dan Bovey. And then we thought we wanted to get a quartet together that was really good players that, you know, played musically, because we heard a lot of guitar quartets, but never ones that we thought were on the same level as maybe a string quartet or a really good brass ensemble. And we just had this vision that that's kind of what we wanted to do with guitar. And then we met this guy who could play scales really fast and also happened to be quite musical, called George Tolton. And that's where the first quartet kind of stuck together. That led us on to our first project. So we've recorded a few CDs in our time. And the first one we did was a collaborative project of the music of the English composer Stephen Dodgson. Have you heard of Stephen Dodgson?
Just
probably
a little bit.
Not the biggest. You have? Okay. So he lived in Barnes in London, and you could describe his music as almost musical watercolor, if you will. It's kind of modernist, but it's got a slight tiny bit of impressionistic twang, maybe a little bit of Janáček in there. It's really lovely stuff. And he'd written a lot for John Williams and Julian Bream back in the 70s and 80s. And then after that, he was writing for teachers of ours who were called the Eden Stell Guitar Duo. And they really kind of hucked us on to the music of Stephen Dodgson. And he'd written one guitar quartet. This guitar quartet's called Change Ringers. It's the first track on our Dodgson album, and it's really nice. It's quite complex. And around that, there were other chamber works with multiple guitars, like a guitar ensemble and something else. So guitar ensemble and cello, guitar ensemble, flute, violin, guitar ensemble and singer, soprano. So the birth of this project of Stephen Dodgson's music kind of started to come together. We were working with his widow, the kind of chairman of his trust. And yeah, we just managed to get this Naxos CD off the ground. And that was our first foray as a quartet.
Is there something?
That's how we kind of.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. There's a slight delay. And let me explain to our audience, those watching, as opposed to listening, there's a slight delay, but also there's a little occasionally freezing of the Zoom, but it's just the way it is where you are at the moment, which is on the moon, from what I understand. That's why the signal is not that good. So anyway, what is it? Is there something magical about a quartet as opposed to a trio or a duo? What is it about a quartet? And can you go even larger than a quartet? And would you want to? You have four great players. And I'll let you mention all the players in the group because two of you are with me. The other two are not. So feel free to talk about your other compatriots as well. So it's a two-part question.
Well, Michael, who is the other member, Michael Button, who joined with me and replaced Dan Bubby, he was on that Dodgson album, is how you met
him. He's one of the collaborators.
So he's been working with the quartet kind of since their beginning as well. I think quartet seems to be like basically the perfect number, especially when you're arranging music not written for guitars, because so much music does work in four voices, taking things orchestrally or taking from vocal music. People normally write for four voices. So it does translate from arrangements, translates quite well to have four. It just gives you a good amount of texture to work with, I think. Any less, if you've got duo or trio, the parts can be quite dense, can be quite difficult to cram everything into an individual part. And with four, you have just enough space to work with, giving everyone interesting, equal things to do.
From a novice, from my point of view, it may seem like a naive question, but when you have four players, are some doing harmony and some doing melody, or are you all on the same page, or are you doing individual solos? I mean, I've seen your performance, so I know that clearly you're all working together, but could you explain it for layman terms or in layman terms about that?
Yeah, now would be a good time to mention our latest album.
Yes, which is called Overtures and Dances, right?
Yes, so that's all new arrangements by us, by different members of the quartet. It's all arrangements of works not written for guitar. So it's orchestral music and solo piano music that we've arranged. And that kind of covers both options you have for arranging. So with solo piano music, we've taken lines that are maybe for one hand or inner voices in a piano piece, and we split them across different members of the ensemble. So maybe you never play a full melody, you get a few notes here, and then you dip into doing some accompanying, and then you have a few notes here. And that way, different lines can overring, like a piano sustain pedal. If you split different notes across different guitars, then things can sustain, a melody can sustain a way that if just one person played it, then it couldn't. And also allows us to play really quick. So we've got a few pieces on the album. The Rachmaninoff Italian Polka is a good example of a very fast solo piano piece that would be impossible for one guitarist to play. By splitting up, literally, I think there's one point where I have like three notes here and then three notes there, and it's going between all the different members of the quartet.
And the overlaying effect is...
Yeah, so you can get ripply, piano sustained single lines. The other option, which is the rest of the album, is huge orchestral works where you have all these different voices and different textures and instruments coming in, and you can dip in and out again. Different members of the quartet can be different instruments, and maybe at one point you're playing a solo horn line or you're playing a woodwind section, and then you can be strings, and that way we can layer up loads of different things. But
so one of the things that I really love about playing in guitar quartet, so I know some of your listeners probably aren't guitarists and they might be familiar with maybe a regular string quartet where the roles are very defined. So you have violin one, who's always at the top, always kind of playing out the tune, and then cello sitting all the ways down below playing the bass. But it's very egalitarian being in a guitar quartet. Everyone can take every role.
Everyone's got the same range and the same instrument to work with. So we can swap. You're not always playing the bass. You're not always playing the tune.
So that makes it really interesting for us as players.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're just like sharing everything. And yeah, that's very exciting as a player. Yeah. You often don't get to do that with guitar. So it's like one of the really rewarding things.
Something that then allows, which maybe you couldn't do with string quartet in both live performing and in recording, is that because everyone is working with the same instrument and the same range, it's up to you as an arranger. You can decide which side of the quartet and which person in the quartet you want to play which melody, which allows you to arrange things spatially that a string quartet wouldn't do, because the cello, who can only access some of the notes, is always going to be sat in one place. But so for this album, especially something like the Debussy arabesques, not only do you decide to who's going to play what note, but you can have things pass spatially around the quartet in one direction and then go back the other way. Mm-hmm. Or you can have, in an orchestra, you can have one voice, like the brass, come in from one side and then that be answered by whoever's sitting on the other side of the quartet, to allow things to work kind of in stereo, which you couldn't do if everyone was defined by their range where they are on the stage.
No, that makes perfect sense. Matthew, you mentioned earlier that you can do things with speed that you couldn't do if you were just one player. So I would imagine you're going to probably do the next album will be Fly to the Bumblebee.
It almost didn't make it. Well, we do play it.
We have played it before.
It just didn't make it onto this one because it's really an overture or a dance.
Yeah, I bet.
But it was Russian. How can we get that in to like match with the Rachmaninoff?
Yeah, but it was an encore piece for a while.
Yeah, it's so hilarious. So that the Bumblebee thing started with at the Royal Academy of Music, you have to do a big technical exam, and there's a specific BPM for your scales that you have to make, and it's really difficult. So Dan Bovey, who was one of the members, was doing a duo's master. So he was there with another guitarist doing duo, and they had to do a duo technical. And they thought, how can we do these scales like in an interesting way? And there's a technique called hocket, which is where you play alternately from one person to the other. It's used in quite a few compositions. There's a famous set by Castelnuovo Tedesco called his 24 Preludes and Fugues. And the one in B major is just alternating notes very, very, very quickly. So it's a very specific little technique. And they thought, wouldn't it be great if we did a chromatic scale in alternating notes? So it's one person playing a whole tone scale and another person playing a whole tone scale, a semitone out. And this kind of was quite fun. And we'd be messing around with it in rehearsal. And either Dan or George, or maybe it was Jeeva, said, hey, that sounds a bit like Flight of the Bumblebee. And then that was born. And that was at the end of every concert for about 10 years.
Yeah, and it makes sense based on the fact that there's four of you. It was the decision-making process in the quartet. Oh, we should point out too again, and I'm going to attempt to do this without falling apart. You're going to give your website again, because you can order the album through the website, melagq.com, melagq.com. Did I do it right? Good. Okay. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, that was perfect.
Thank you. Okay. When it comes to decision-making, because there's four of you, so you have the founding members and the new members, do the founding members get an additional vote? Or is it all very egalitarian in the sense that you all are deciding what you're going to play and who's going to play what?
I think that it's people get given, it's main. It's like if you find that repertoire, then often it's up to you to arrange that repertoire, and then you maybe have the choices in how you arrange it.
Yeah, if you've done more listening than everyone else, you'll probably have more of an opinion or like an invested interest in something. So you'll want that to be tried out first. But one of the great things about working with other people in chamber music is you should try every idea, even if it's not going to work, even if you think it won't work. Because if you listen to something and that confirms to you that it doesn't work, it'll solidify your other idea. Or it will give you a new idea, or maybe that other idea that was a bit crazy, maybe that is a good idea and it works in some way. Sometimes the opposite of a good idea is also a good idea.
But do you ever vote, for example, let's say someone picks a particular piece of music, they work on it, they arrange it, They've assigned the parts of it to all of you. But then three out of the four members of the quartet say, well, you know, we don't think this will work on a sustainable basis as we continue our tour. Does that happen, or is it once it's
yeah,
in?
Yes,
there's a couple of times things will never get fully done. We'll never get to like the point where we're rehearsing and performing something and then go, actually, this isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. It normally would along the way come up. But yeah, we had one huge piece that would have been over 15 minutes, big work that was going to be on the album. And we thought this is just it's not worth.
Yeah, the amount of time for getting the album ready, because we knew we wanted to have it released before we came to America. And we had this specific window where we had to record. And then you can plan how much rehearsal you can get. And then we're just staring in the face of this like almost 20 minute Borodin Polyptian dances. And
we could fill it with so many smaller things that would work better and would be more effective than the guitar.
Less is more.
We did a couple of runs of concerts, and we thought we've got one too many things on the program.
We're slightly delayed on Zoom. That's why it sounds like you're cutting off or I'm cutting over you. When you play and you tour, does it not amaze you? Are you satisfied by the fact that there are still people that want to hear classical, semi-classical music as opposed to 20, 30, 40 years ago? Because it's a very different market today than it would have been 40 years ago. There was probably more of it back then than there is now. But are you surprised at the popularity of the music?
No, I think the appeal of the music is universal. It's just like any art, any kind of higher. You could walk into an art gallery and look at a piece of Van Gogh, and then it will speak to you on a human level that maybe you're not even consciously aware of. It just, you have a connection with it. And there's so many people that I've just shoved the Debussy arabesques in front of them and said, listen to this. And they instantly know that it's beautiful. It's a masterwork. It's something that is very rare, but also incredibly beautiful. And that has appeal for forever. It will never go out of popularity.
That's good to know. It's hopeful about civilization that certain pieces of art,
I like to keep it.
Yeah, we'll be there forever. I don't know if the Van Gogh, if it speaks to you because he's got one of the ear missing, he might not hear you back when you speak back to him. But just a thought I had here, which makes no sense at all, but that's okay. So when you joined the group, were there expectations that you had to perform at a very high level in order to be a member of this quartet?
I mean, I guess, yes, it's very, I think some of the music is very demanding, and I definitely, but put in a lot of effort in the first few months to really learn it all very quickly. So I was a student of George's, and I had seen the quartet perform many times before joining. Mm-hmm. And it was actually during my university degree, I did a project of arrangements based on, or very inspired by the arrangements that Mella had done. I'd heard the Debussy arabesques and I'd heard the Glinka arrangement. And so I was really inspired by them and really looked up to the work that they'd done. So then when I was asked to be in it, I was like, absolutely, definitely, I'll put in the work very quickly to try and learn the music.
Tell you what, we got better when they joined. Because when you have people coming in that, you know, the time is short and they're really focusing and they're really good players, then we also had to up our game. So I think we're sounding better than we've ever sounded.
No, that's great. Well, it's got to be bizarre. It's got to be unusual. As you mentioned, you were aware of the quartet and you saw them perform, and now you're in that seat. So you went from outside to inside. So there's got to be a unusual feeling occasionally when you're performing. All of a sudden, your brain says to you, you realize I'm here performing on stage where just 5 years ago I was watching them from the outside, or something like that.
Yes. Well, one of the comments that we get the most after we perform, we have one work that we performed by our friend composer, Laura Snowden. She has a brilliant piece that she wrote for Mella called my clock is broken. And I'd say the number one comment we get after every concert is people coming up and saying, wow, that piece was incredible. I've never heard anything like it. I didn't know you could make those sounds on guitar, and I didn't know that that music could move me in such a way. And my response is always, I know, because I was in the audience and I have had that exact reaction watching other people play this piece. And now I get to be the one that plays that piece and gives that atmosphere and creates that for the people in the audience. So I feel quite lucky that everyone comes up, and when people say nice things about the quartet, my response is always, I know, because I exactly felt that in the past being an audience member. And now I get to be able to play that music.
When the both of you are playing, well, all the full quartet, the quartet, when you're both playing, when you're all four of you are playing, and you mentioned, Matthew, earlier that art, is, great art is eternal. Do you feel you're in that, tapping into that eternal stream when you're playing classic music?
Yes. I think one of the draws for me of classical music was that it kind of opened my mind to, I don't know, just to so much. I felt like I was taken to another place, and you can almost see like infinity, weirdly to say that, but I did kind of feel like that. The music that we've chosen and the repertoire choice, I think, is kind of from that experience. It's from that view of music that we're trying to open it out to everyone, really. We're not doing just guitar music for guitarists. We're quite deliberately choosing a repertoire that I think anyone that was even slightly open to music would really enjoy. And the variety that we have throughout the whole program means that they're taken on a kind of a whirlwind journey, really, of things that are incredibly impressively high energy, and then something that is the sweetest, most delicate, beautiful thing, things that are almost transparent in their sound. And that's kind of the impressionistic stuff, that it just kind of floats there. And then something that's a little bit harder and a bit more kind of almost slightly academic, but not in a non-interesting way. So I'm talking about the Holst there. So if anyone's seen the or heard Star Wars, then they've heard basically the Planet Suite, which was the composer of this work, Fugal Overture, that we arranged for quartet. And that one's kind of, you can hear the machines of war in it. So this kind of little journey that we're taking everyone on is just really fun to curate as a quartet, to decide what you want to present to people, to entertain, but also to kind of move.
Do you find it, and I've asked this of other guests over the years, do you find, because you have an impact when you're performing in front of a live audience, it's different than when you're recording, as in your current album? So do you look at it and do you not get the same feeling when you're recording a particular piece versus when you're performing it in front of an audience? And I'll ask it of both of you, because you obviously both have different
feelings.
It is definitely a different feeling.
We just recorded yesterday, didn't we? Other piece, and that felt good, but it felt very different to actually performing.
There's something about, there's a silence, but when an audience is present, especially after the end of a piece, for example, that Rachmaninoff ends very cheekily, very excitingly, and there's a kind of suspense that hangs in the air when everyone is still. Hasn't relaxed it after the end of the piece, and you kind of, I like, so there's a lot of pieces, like Laura piece especially, sometimes people have a little gasp and you can hear the audience react to the piece. And there's something about that responsiveness of people listening in real time and experiencing and appreciating in real time, which you can't get through recording. But conversely, the recording that we've done, so we recorded this album with a Dutch label called Triptych. We recorded it in the Netherlands with them. You'll have to talk about the specifics of it, but we recorded it in a very specific way that allows a lot of detail to be present on the album, so that maybe people listening to the album rather than listening to us in person could still have that same response as an audience. So we've tried through the way we've recorded this album to provide the experience of listening to us live to people that might be listening at home.
When you're recording... No, thank you. When you're recording in the album, when you're recording an album itself, clearly the engineer or engineers are listening to you, but they're listening more from a technical standpoint. They want to make sure that the sound is right and the instruments sound right, etc. But I would imagine you still get feedback from the engineers after you perform a piece where they say that was great in terms of the actual performance, or am I wrong when it comes to what the feedback is?
Well, it's like... It's the Beatles and George Martin, like your producer is your fifth member. And when we recorded our other CDs, we had the kind of genius producer, John Taylor, who's recorded a lot of classical guitar music. And that set of ears outside and hearing your idea and kind of critically pinpointing, I don't think that idea goes as far as you think it goes, or it's not achieving what you think you're achieving. Try this instead. And it's just like having a really fantastic mirror to bounce back straight away, which is super important. And it helps shape your interpretation of what you're doing. The recording we did yesterday was of this concerto by the English composer Anthony Burgess. And we were recording just sections that were only guitar. So we had a conductor there. And he was basically doing the same job as a producer and saying, oh, can I just hear a little bit more bass line there, or that guitar three a little bit more here? And that growl didn't quite work. But yeah, I think that's really vital that you have a musical set of ears listening to you and not just a technical set of ears.
Right. So besides the engineers, you have a producer right there, making sure that the sound is not just technically correct, that would be the engineer's part, but that it's communicating what you want it to communicate musically. Yeah. Is that right?
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. Sorry, we're slightly delayed again by Zoom, so I apologize to our audience. They have a terrible connection where they were talking to me from. Before I let you go, what do you look at as the future for the Mela Guitar Quartet? And we mentioned, of course, your album, which is available on the website too, called Overtures and Dances. And I'm gonna give the website out again. I hopefully won't stumble over it when I give it at the end there too. But what do you see as the future for the quartet?
Well, Zara mentioned the Laura Snowden piece, and that is turning out to be everyone's favorite piece, or at least one of the favorite pieces from the concert. So they're begging us to record that. And we just have ideas about a commission CD, because we've expanded the repertoire in terms of arranging. And I think the next natural step is to expand it in terms of originality, composition wise. We've got other projects and things on the boil too, but I think getting Laura's piece out into the world in a really lovely recording, I think that would be very important.
And in the very short term, we have on Friday, we're performing the US premiere of this Burgess concerto, which has also been recorded. So that will be coming out.
That's at Stanford University in the Bing Concert Hall.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guests have been Matthew Robinson and Zara. Oh, there it is right there.
Zara's artwork.
There we go. My guests have been Matthew Robinson and Zara Hutton, and they are two out of the four of the Mela Guitar Quartet. They're going to be performing their final concert of the UNLV Performing Arts Center's 48th season, which is Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 at the Artemis W. Ham Concert Hall. And for ticket information, go to pac.unlv.edu. That's pac.unlv.edu. And for everything about the Mela Guitar Quartet, go to Mela and then MELAGQ.com, MELAGQ.com, and follow them on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And thanks very much for being on the show, Zara and Matthew.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Hey, Las Vegas. Anything you want us to be.